Robinson, host of BBS Radio's Conscious Creating. I'd like to welcome all of our listeners tonight as we continue our conversations on the relationship between art making and transformation. This week, I'm privileged to welcome yet another distinguished guest from the fields of writing and visual art. Mary Carol Nelson is the author of over 11 books, including The Legendary Artists of Taos and Artists of the Spirit. Her artworks are mixed media, dimensional shrines of transparent plexiglass, which are often illuminated. In addition to her work as a writer and visual artist, Mary spent over 20 years as a teacher and is the founder of the Society of Layerists in Multimedia. Welcome, Mary.
Welcome to me. I'm happy to talk to you.
Where were you born?
I was born in Texas at College Station. My father was an Army officer, and he was stationed there.
So they're not from, your parents weren't from Texas originally then?
No, they were from New York and from Missouri.
Oh.
But our life was spent moving from one place to the other.
Okay. Well, I have a theory. I lived in Texas for almost 20 years, and I have a theory that there's 6 degrees of separation with Texans. Everybody has a Texas connection, and they're all great people.
Well, I really like Texas. I hadn't been back for a long, long time, but then we ended up being stationed there, too, because my husband was in the Army as well,
mm-hmm.
and our son was born there, and my brother lives there, so we still have connections.
Well, then you went on and you received your BA from Barnard Women's College in
mm-hmm.
New York and majored in art history and then later went on to earn an MA in art education from the University of New Mexico.
Yes.
But I'm interested to back up a little bit and know how art figured in your early years before you started your formal education.
I really attribute that to my mother. She was a Barnard graduate, and she was a psychology major, a partner to Margaret Mead, as a matter of fact. And she really looked for qualities in her children and then promoted them. And I drew a lot. Of course, all children draw a lot. But she and her father decided that I was destined to be a cartoonist because I drew things they thought were amusing. I thought they were serious. They thought they were amusing. But anyway, my grandfather started sending me Punch, you know, the British cartoon magazine. I was 5 years old. I had no idea what it was about. But he sent it to me anyway. And so I was always encouraged to do art.
That's wonderful. Some people are not encouraged early on. And would you say initially you had a talent as a representational artist or...
I think that I began that way. I think most people do. You try to draw something that looks like what you're expecting it to, and you work really hard to gain control of a medium. That's the normal process, and then later on you begin to loosen up and find the things that matter to you. And I was still making an effort to do realistic things until I got to college. And then I had some teachers who really were encouraging of expression and much more about just the materials. And that was useful. It helped me kind of spring loose a little bit.
I imagine Barnard was a wonderful place to be at the time.
For art history, it's just magical. Mm-hmm. Our assignments were down into the museums. I was in the museums day after day, week after week for years. And it's very different to study art history with the actual works and to do it through slides and university prints and things like that. And in my day, you didn't have any color in those things. Everything was black and white and just a few color plates. So you really were reinforced if you went down and saw the actual work.
So you were very fortunate to be in New York then.
Oh, yes. It was a wonderful time and... it's an excellent school, really.
My father graduated Columbia and was there at the same time you were,
mm-hmm.
and lived down in Greenwich Village and was part of that whole New York Expressionist thing that was going on then. And so I sort of have a feel for what your life must have been like. It was an exciting time, wasn't it?
It really was. They had no studio work at Barnard in those days. They do now. So we took ours over at Columbia, And they always acted like we were stepchildren, so we had to lug all our stuff over there every week. But we did it, and we had a wonderful time, so it was good.
Now, you were raised Catholic. And,
yeah.
You say that your Catholicism exposed you to the great mysteries of the church, the Mass, saints, sacred music, that kind of thing.
And yes, it was very aesthetic. It really is. Well, somewhat different today with guitars, but the Mass on its own, just the regular Mass, is an aesthetic experience if you see it that way. And so you're left with the scent of the incense and the ringing of bells. There were a lot of lovely aspects to it. And then the colors of the different seasons of the church. So it was a rich visual experience, and of course that has something to do with your sense of the spirit, I think.
I think so, too. So this did then affect your artistic sensibilities on some level?
Oh, I think so, yes. Yes, I do. You can respond to your religion in any way you're geared to. We have our own sensorium, but for me, it was a mystical experience to go to Mass. And it was only later, I must admit, that I had a hard time with the masculine dominance of the church. And that began to be very important to me later after I became more assured of what I believed about the role of the feminine in the world and things like that.
Right.
But I would never want to turn my back on the church, nor would I want to ever wish I had not been brought up Catholic. I think that it gives you somewhere to plug in to the life of the spirit to be brought up in some religion. And then from there, you really are sort of required, I think, to develop your own system of belief and keep what you want and add to it what you learn. Don't you think that's true?
Absolutely. And yeah. I really try to teach my children that. We're Episcopalian, not too different from Catholic.
No, not at all.
And I just try to say, you know, listen and make of it what you will. And I think we have some good conversations based on some of the things they hear, and so it works out well. But I'm interested in when you were first the holistic movement and how that began to influence you, because that's very different from the dualism of Catholicism.
Oh, yes, it is. And it had a lot to do with the kind of accretion of ideas that led me to establish a different set of practices and beliefs, I think, a little bit for myself. Let's see, what did start it? I think some of the things that started it were books. I learn a lot through books. I do think we read things in order to confirm what we already sense that we think.
Yeah.
But the first thing that influenced me was this book that practically nobody ever read, but it was called Human Destiny. Mm-hmm. And it came out in the 50s. It was written by a Frenchman, Le Comte de Nuit. And he was trying to synthesize religion and science. Now, I'm not educated in science at all, but the prose of science, I really am attracted to.
Mm-hmm.
And that book was such a joy for me. I really enjoyed it. And then anything that smacks of a kind of mystical dimension, like all of the things about Fatima and all of this, they opened up my thoughts that there's a great deal that is not seen that we experience all the time, that more or less we live in different dimensions when we're dealing with the dishes and with dinner and when we are dealing with our sense of the spirit, and that they're both true and they're both valid and we exist in both dimensions.
You mean you don't have a mystical experience when you're cleaning the toilet?
I have an awful lot of good ideas when I'm doing the dishes and cooking. I make hundreds of salads. We eat salad every day. And one time I tried to do just a rough calculation of how many tossed salads I'd made in my life, and it was astronomical. But I find that very much an opening into the life of the spirit. You chop, chop, and you think of things that really send you soaring sometimes.
I was in my garden for 3 hours today, just weeding and getting dirt under my fingernails, and I thought, it just you know, this is a dimension that is really a gateway into the mystical dimension because we're connecting with the earth. Do you find that?
Yes, I do. I think that there's so many doorways in the end of day that you have to be very alert. And I'm sure you've had this experience that the more alert you are, the more times in a day that you feel that you sense a connection to something else or a broader part of yourself, I would say. And I just think that's thrilling if it happens, and it often does, so I look for it, and I expect it. So I think what you expect is pretty much what you get sometimes.
I do, too.
Mm-hmm.
So do you feel that it's important for artists to feed their imaginations with time spent in nature and doing what some might call mundane tasks?
Well, you know, I spent years writing about artists and doing interviews and learning about what their methods are and things. I've never met an artist who didn't have a little ritual. It may be very, very simple. One artist really stuck in my mind because every morning he went in the studio, and whether it was necessary or not, he sharpened pencils. That sounds funny, doesn't it? But he sharpened them, and then when he had this beautiful line of perfect pencils, he'd sit down, and then something would start to come to him. And I just found so many different ways that people have triggered their entry into the creative part of themselves. There are artists, and I do believe anyone who makes art is an artist, whether it's commercial art or fine art. And I do believe there are some people probably who are so into it, they're just so practiced at what they do that they may just jump into their work. But I never interviewed anyone like that.
Will you share your rituals with us?
Well, I have funny ways. Right now, I have a torn rotary cuff. I don't recommend it. And I needed physical therapy. So I'm taking physical therapy. And the first time I was in a session, because I'd never done this before, they have this strange machine where they pull your neck and then let go and pull your neck, let go. And I had my eyes closed, and I went right into a blue light, and I began to see art images. So I told the therapist, who at first thought I was kidding, that if I can just keep this up, I think by the end of a few more sessions, I'll have the whole thing worked out. And then
you'll
I'll
have a new show, won't you?
And so, actually, I did finally come up with the whole image, and I'm trying to draw sketches of it. And I'm almost through with the physical therapies, too, I might say, thank heaven.
Oh, good. But
yeah.
You need to heal, because this affects your art is very physical. You work in three-dimensional sort of pieces. Are you still working that way with me?
Well, yes, I am. But I had to stop there for a while. This whole thing started in December. I was kind of restricted. But I tried doing my work again, and I do a lot of stippling. And if I work very close to me, don't reach out across the table, I can do it. So I'm working on ways to do it with little elements. And then I can put the little elements together, and I think I'll have a way to make art until I get over this.
Well, that's good. You have to get your daily fix if you're an artist.
Yeah, you really do.
Well, I want to go back to something you alluded to earlier. You said that one of the things that you were glad to be raised as a Catholic, but one of the things that pushed you away from Catholicism, or at least made you step back and look at it more closely, was the patriarchy.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in reading Artists of the Spirit to look at your views on gender and androgyny in particular, because this has had a big impact on my work as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like to hear a little bit about how these ideas about gender have expanded your view of art or influenced your art.
I'm not certain where it fits in my art, except that I'm very keen on the notion that there is a part of us, if we're women, that is masculine. And there's a part in men that is feminine. And that we should honor that in each other. And in my work, I tend to be aware of balancing. I often do symmetrical things. I can't say that I consciously am acting out on what we're talking about. But in my thinking, watching how the feminist movement got completely distorted through a kind of hatred, really, for men, that really bothered me. And I spent quite a lot of time reading things like Animus and Hillman and James Hillman and others on the whole subject of animus. And I think that we tend to talk about the anima, that men have an anima. I don't think we've talked as much as we ought to that women have an animus, and that they should acknowledge that and let it develop and grow and not be something that is difficult for them. Now, as you get older, the man, if he's having a normal development, his anima becomes more prominent. He becomes less of the more the typical characteristics of the animus and becomes more into his anima. And I've noticed that women, as they get older, they become more assured. They often become more in the world and less in the home, more outspoken perhaps, yeah. Just a little bit different, not a lot, but that is their animus that has grown and become obvious.
And then we're labeled eccentric when our animus starts coming through, right?
Yeah. Start wearing purple hats. Well, somewhere it's gone a little bit overboard.
But those are the people I like.
People that often end up running clubs or something.
I started noticing that I'm attracted to people of both sexes who have a well-developed sense of their opposite. And do you actually notice that in people, or have
you been aware
of it? Like I've said to my friends, one of the things I love about my husband is that he has a well-developed anima, and they'll look at me like I'm crazy. But are you aware of it?
Yes, I'm very aware of it, and I'm very grateful that I have an extremely kind and very nourishing husband. And at the same time, he's a very masculine man.
Yes.
And I think that you have to complement one another. By that I mean, you know, to fit together in a way where both of your qualities support a union. But you also need to use the other form of the word, complement. Say that you like these things that are being done for you and the sharing and support that you're getting. There's something wrong with the way that younger people are relating in the sense that is it okay for a man to show his sensitive side today to a young woman? In other words, what is she looking for? I'm really not certain because the images of male and female are no longer very easy to perceive in the younger society. Mm. It's very confused, and I think it's harder and harder for the youngest people to find their partner.
Hmm. Perhaps so. I don't know. I do think that young men are beginning to be able to express themselves in a feminine way or more traditionally feminine ways without being condemned as much as they, you know, had in mm-hmm. past generations. I see this with my own children and their friends. But you're right. It's I always say finding that right mate is sort of dumb luck in a way.
Well, it seems to be. I'm awfully glad that my luck was so good.
And you've been married quite a long time.
Oh gosh, I'm heading for 56 years.
Heaven.
Yeah.
That's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back a little bit to the gender issue, I've looked at a number of your images. Can't wait to see them in person, but I've seen the images of your work, and I'm moved by their femininity. I just really think they're beautifully feminine, and yet in a mythic way rather than in a very specific, what would be considered traditionally feminine way. And I especially love Sophia's mandala. I was really drawn to that piece because my last play had the goddess of wisdom as one of the central characters.
Yes.
So it made me want to ask you the question, do you think the goddess is on the rise in contemporary culture?
I think the feminine impulse is very powerful. I call it exigent. It's an exigent energy. It's pretty overwhelming, and this is where I think that it's very difficult right now for men, because this sense of the Sophia quality is very powerful in society. And I like to poke around and learn a little bit about the Kabbalah, and that's kind of where I started thinking about Sophia.
Shekinah, is that it?
Mm-hmm, the Shekinah. And one of the things that interested me a lot, and I did do an artwork about it, was that every attribute of Mary, that would be the moon, the blue cloak, the dove, the rose, all of those things were already attributes of Sophia.
Right.
So you see this lineage that was kept alive, and you have to honor that history in the church, that the feminine sense of the sacred was really not lost. It was always there. And in those cathedrals in England, you know, and in the other countries of Europe, usually there's a black Madonna, or there's some reverence somewhere for the feminine as sacred. And so really that's a tremendously long lineage. And some friends of mine are much more deeply involved in that as their subject than I am. But I did do a series about Sophia because on the Tree of Life, wisdom is a feminine attribute. That's rather pleasant, isn't it?
Yes. It is pleasant.
Yeah.
And I drew, you and I have a common book, The Women's Encyclopedia of
Symbols.
And symbols, and drew on a lot of my character. I got a lot of the information from that encyclopedia. It's a wonderful book. And when you create a work, do you let all of it come from your imagination, or do you actually do research to prepare?
I do some research, because one of the things that I just am caught up in is these space images from the Hubble and elsewhere.
Right.
And I am so captivated by them, so that I do study them. But I don't want to exactly copy them. So after I've studied them, I try to draw it freehand and put the coloring in of my own choosing. But there's something that just constantly gets to me about galaxies, especially the spiral, pure circular galaxies.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
just so gorgeous. And I usually try to make some sense of analogy. Alfred Stieglitz, who was O'Keefe's husband,
right,
he used to use the word equivalence, that this was equivalent to that. And when he was talking about that, he was using cloud images in his photography, which were really quite beautiful. Well, that word stuck in my mind, and I thought, I want to do equivalence. I want to have the space image, and then I'd like to have something that would be considered an earth image. So it's as above, so below. And I became fixated on the crop formations that are showing up all around the world and are absolutely beautiful. They're just gorgeous. And often they are recognizable, in a sense, as ancient symbols or as modern fractals. It's just amazing how many symbols are in these circles that have meaning to us. So I might put a galaxy on one side of a piece and then a crop formation on the other, and I'm trying to say that this is an echo effect.
The equivalent as above.
Yes.
Equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Mary Carol Nelson is our guest tonight on Conscious Creating, and We're going to take a short break, and we hope you'll stay with us. We're back now with Conscious Creating with Mary Carol Nelson. This is your host, Sarah Robinson. We've been talking about the relationship between your art making and various types of transformation and ideologies. And I read where you said, Mary, that maturity has a singular virtue. It provides us with a long view backwards to those pivotal encounters that direct our curiosity. I love that quote, and I'd like to hear you reflect on it a bit, if you could, and sort of talk about the effect of age and maturity and what effect that's had on your work.
It's given me more images and experiences to compare to more recent ones. As you build up a kind of an encyclopedia for yourself of your own encounters and your own experiences, you have more to bring to an experience to help you possibly become more objective or to see more connecting links between what's happening around you at the moment and all sorts of other things that have already happened. And that has nourished in me this idea of this web. So we're all in a web of time and space, and everything in it is unified. It's all connected together. And that is really my take on the idea of the holistic principle, is this unity that is an existence. There is no place to disconnect. At least not as long as we're human. You cannot be outside of the web of time and space. And so it's had a lot of effect on me and my thinking. But as in the place where that quote is, I was leading into the subject of books, of course.
Yes.
Things that fed my ideas along the way. And I was amazed when I did that work. I was amazed at how much of the things that I'd read that I remembered. That certain things have just stayed there and have become part of this web. And we build our own web according to the things that we're sort of built to understand. I think everybody would have a different set of things that they'd remember that were pivotal to them.
Right. And I wonder if this is by happenstance or if there is some conjuring that we do to make these things happen. And you said before that the right book, you know, has consistently fallen into your hands and found you. And people say, you know, that the teacher will find you when you're ready. What are your views on that? How does that all fit into the holistic?
Well, I absolutely swear by that idea. I've had so many experiences in so-called coincidences or synchronicities that are so apt at exactly the right moment that I am totally aware that there is a law of attraction. We attract into our orbit when we need it some resonant thing that we need. And I don't really think it's an accident. I think this is the way the universe operates. Once we become conscious that we have a certain power in our thinking. I do think thought is creative, and I think it's very powerful.
Yes.
I have an experience I'll tell you about. It just really blew me away. I wanted to have in the Artist of the Spirit book that you mentioned an even balance of artists and wiser healing people, and also an even balance of women and men and other ways of balancing. But I lacked two people. And they, in both cases, they had to be on the healing side. So I thought, well, there's nothing to do but just send up a prayer and hope for the best. And I was on my way out of my workroom with piles of stuff to mail when the phone rang, and that led to the woman that I needed. And then when I got back from the post office, I had another phone call from a woman who was just peripheral in my life, someone that calls very, very rarely. And she started talking about having an appointment with a healer in Santa Fe. And that turned out to be Miguel Angel Ruiz, with whom I then went on to have a very long close friendship, and he was the last chapter of that book. I mean, there it was, you know. That's
that
a pretty
amazing.
Quick answer to
and I was going to ask you how the two of you formed your collaboration, and were you instantly attracted to one another? Did he know that you sort of got his work, so to speak, that you understood
it? Well, I really didn't know anything about him. What I did was I hung up from the phone call with this friend, who, by the way, never did keep her appointment with him. And I called and made an appointment for the next week. And I went up, and I was supposed to be there at a certain hour. And the person who usually made his appointments had not been there, so he had made the appointment himself. And it overlapped. I was not really the only one who had been told to come at that time. And the other person was there for a healing experience. And she told me, "Why don't you come and watch?" And he said, "Oh, that would be fine." And so, you know, from not knowing a thing, I ended up witnessing this extraordinary episode of his trying to bring healing to her. He does not do these physical healings anymore, but at that time he did. And realizing very quickly that he was in a really a trance state. Mm-hmm. And when the whole thing was over, she said, "Oh, that is such a blessing." She said, I'm pain-free, and I'm going on a trip, and I'm just so grateful for this. Mm-hmm. So then I sat down with Ruiz and on a couch, and he wanted to know pretty much why are you here? And I told him about my book. And he said, well, he had been getting a strong impression that someone was going to come to write about him. And so he took my hands and held them, and we visited for a little while. You know, we're not used to that. We're not used to holding on like this and being inside a small space. Most of us like 3 feet around us all the time.
Right.
So I must say I was a little uncomfortable with it. But after we'd been talking for a little while, and he's very soft-spoken and very sweet, and at that time he had less English than, of course, now he has fine command. He decided that I was safe and was okay. So we made a lot of appointments over the next several years and visited back and forth. I did finish his story for my book, but before I finished it, he asked me to write his teaching. So that's why our relationship continued.
And that was beyond fear.
Yes.
Right. And just to let our audience know, if they're not familiar with the work of Don Miguel Ruiz, he is noted for the Four Agreements and many other books.
Yes, he is a Toltec Nahual, and that is not something that he came to after he was an adult. He is in the lineage of Toltec Nahual. His parents, well, at least his mother, his grandfather, all the way back. He can pretty well track that back for more than a couple of hundred years. So this is part of what he was exposed to. And he was trained in the sense that tribal Native Americans here will train, like, say, a shaman. It's done experientially. It's not really sit down here and I'm going to teach you something. So he had acquired a great deal of shamanic wisdom before he was ever an adult. And then he followed his brothers and became a doctor. But eventually his mother asked him to come and apprentice with her, and he would do that on the weekends. And he became devoted to her way of teaching and stopped the doctoring.
Right. It became a different kind of healer.
Yes, he did.
One of the things I most admire about you as an artist, and when I say that, I mean as a writer, as a visual artist, I'm sure there are other mediums in which you create, is you're a collaborator.
Yes, I think I am.
And so many artists I've encountered in my career have been self-absorbed and very, and not one to easily collaborate, but you seem to seek that out, and you must have a tremendous amount of energy to be able to to be so interested and involved in other people's lives and write about them, and then to create your own work. Do you see the two as complementary?
I think the fact that I do my own work and have the same experiences of struggling to bring something into being makes me a little more open and sensitive to the person that I'm talking with, who also is doing that. And usually the people that I've interviewed are very accomplished people, and I become their fans. And then for them, the rest of my life, they're always going to be part of my inner sanctum. You know, I feel like I knew them when, and I always care about what happens to their career. So I don't know. It's a personal kind of thing, and I really enjoy that, but I don't do that kind of interviewing now very much, not really much at all. But I do work with a lot of other people as part of this art society, and just part of my life. It's the way things are. You know, we all have a basic personality, a basic framework for ourselves. I really think that mine is teacher, cutting away everything else. Whether I'm doing my art or doing my writing or anything, I always really feel like I'm trying to make a lesson plan, you know, to put it all together so that someone can make some sense of it and learn something from it.
You write beautifully, and
I commend
your works to the listening audience. I hope you will seek out the work of Mary Carol Nelson. She is a beautiful writer, very... You explain things in a way that I think just about anyone could understand, but I was talking to Thomas Moore about this last week. There's a musicality to your writing.
I'm very pleased to hear that. I don't think of it that way. I think of it as just, I'm just trying to make it flow a little bit and to be lucid, not have extra words, and try and get the point across. So I'm happy if it comes across with some aesthetic quality too.
Yes, definitely. And I want to quote you again, if you don't mind, in Artist of the Spirit, where you're exploring the kinship between artists and prophets or visionaries. You say, "On all sides are people with the talent for prophecy who tell us there is divinity within each of us, man and woman. We are co-creators, responsible for this planet and our own evolution. And it is time to claim our own empowerment." That's a powerful statement.
Well, the book is not new anymore, but I still believe heartily in that statement.
So what role do we have as artists? Are we, if we're co-creators, are we... prophets? Are we priests? Are we gods? I mean,
I think all of us have a bit of God in us. I think we're all essentially divine spirits. But in the sense of where the prophets are, I think they're just everywhere. We're being bombarded almost with really keen insights from all kinds of people. It's like, I think it's a golden age of prophecy, very similar to what it must have been like during the biblical period, that they're very wise people, and they seem to be able to see further than most of us, and they bring back some very useful information. Now, artists really are, by nature, sign makers. They are people who perceive just a tad ahead of the crowd. And I am proposing that we should turn to artists because of the way they think. They think horizontally. They don't come to closure. They're flexible. We should turn to them for leadership now. I've been thinking about this a lot this past week, that we really need flexible thinking. And artists have that. And these prophetic people also have it. It's a gift of the spirit. It really is. So I think we've just about used up the kind of leadership that is worldwide now, that sees everything as divided, like yes, no, good, bad, we and they, and something is always on the other side.
Right.
I don't think artists do think like that as much.
Well, I think sometimes there's pressure for artists to succumb to commerciality and to alter their work or engage in activities with their work that does not fulfill them in order to make a living.
I agree with that.
Certainly watched that happen. And then it seems to me that something does change in people when they prostitute themselves, I guess.
Well, they get stopped before they had made their transformation. And that word that you've used, I just think it's almost the key word for the period we're living in. I just think this is about the most exciting time to be alive that's ever been true on the face of the planet. And I know that there are a lot of things that we should feel terrible about, but there's more that we should feel wonderful about. And one of those things is that if you look in the different disciplines, in the academic world in particular, you'll see that people are breaking down barriers. It's very much more common for people to have a double major or triple major. They're making their own connections between one kind of thinking and another. I just feel that that's a more vital impulse on the planet now, is to come together than it is to be broken apart into all of these factions.
And so would that be weaving the web that you referred to earlier?
I think so. And I think artists have a particularly keen set of qualities that are needed now. And I would recommend another book of George T. Land. This was recommended to me years ago by Beth Ames Swart, a really wonderful artist in Scottsdale, Arizona. And Land has this sort of paradigm of transformation, and he uses the artist as an example, that if you stop, like you're talking about, and you just say, oh, well, this is the painting that sells, and you don't go past it, then literally you stopped your progress. But if you push through, then you're a novice again. It's scary, but you try something you've never done before.
Yeah.
And then you have the ability to reach back and help other people pull them through that transformative time, too. And that's when the artist is the teacher.
And this is absolutely true in other fields as well, in theater, the actor makes an emotional connection with another actor and allows himself or herself in that moment to, as you said, push through to something new. And I've seen this and experienced it, and it is a beautiful thing when it happens.
Oh, it is. And you can almost feel it as an almost tangible thing. And, of course, theater is also the arts and music and dance. People have these moments of just flash or something. But the people who have done the scary thing and have moved ahead, left behind the safety of what they had mastered, they have changed fundamentally into some new form of person. And that's where you have your masters, I think.
Well, and you have led a movement in this country for that sort of change. Can you talk with us about the Layerist Movement?
Well, the Layerist Movement grew out of my writing and interviewing people and finding out that people who did many different kinds of things had similar thoughts, and that they were keen about science, even though they weren't any better trained in science than I am. But they were looking for thoughts of collectiveness, the collective unconscious from Jung and relativity from Einstein. These things had trickled down into the vernacular. It wasn't that we could explain them through the scientific language, but they came out in their work, in their intention. And after a while, I just needed to sit down and describe that, make a word for it. And it took me quite a long time to come up with layering, but I finally realized that they are putting together layers, not just of stuff, because all artists do that. We all put one thing down and something else. They're putting down layers of intention and meaning and content into their work. So these people, these certain people, became part of my list of people that I have collected through the history of art. who seemed to be on that wavelength. And one thing led to another, and eventually I presented the idea of layering to our local museum with a few slides. And that was 1982, and we had an exhibition in 85, and we've just been trotting along ever since. We started with 5 people, and there are closer to 450 members, I think, now. They're branching into Canada.
You've written books, and
we've done some nice publications, yes. We had a book that has become a rare book called Bridging Time and Space. A few copies of that are left, and then we have the new book is called The Art of Layering, Making Connections, which is nearly all devoted to images and just dividers with poetic words on it. A few essays.
So does one have to be a visual artist to join layers?
No.
So you have people from other fields as well?
We encourage people to become an associate member if they are interested in our basic premise. And the premise is on the web,
right?
The SLMM.org. SLMM stands for the Society of Layerists and Multimedia. We don't mean that people are doing their work in multiple mediums. We mean that any medium is fine. And we have had filmmakers in the past, and all kinds of different people are attracted to it. Though, of course, mostly they're visual artists.
I'm attracted to it.
Well, we'd love to have you become an associate member. It'd be great.
Thank you.
Well, I do admire what you're doing. I want to tell you that I'm in total resonance with your concept, and I'm very flattered to be part of it.
Well, thank you. I'm humbled and honored to speak with you and all of the other wonderful people we'll be talking to over the next few months, but It is a treat.
Well, it's been fun for me to speak with you because I'm very tempted, of course, to turn around and start interviewing you, but I'm resisting the impulse.
Well, we can do that offline.
Okay.
But I do want this to be a conversation, and I have enjoyed talking with you tonight, Mary Carol Nelson. Thank you so much for being with us. I hope you'll come back.
Well,
we
thank
can continue
you.
The dialogue.
Well, we'll look forward to it.
If you'd like to learn more about Mary Carol Nelson's work, visit her homepage at www.slmm.org. Thank you for joining us on Conscious Creating this and every Thursday evening from 6 until 7 p.m. Pacific Time. This is your host, Sarah Robinson, wishing you a blissful week of conscious creating.